Today's episode of the Film Stage Show is brought to you by Mubi. For your free 30-day trial, all you gotta do is go to mubi.com/filmstage. Ladies and gentlemen, to a brand new episode of the Film Stage Show, the movie review podcast for thefilmstage.com. As always, I'm your host, Brian J. Rowan. With me today to talk about Spider-Man Homecoming, we have Michael Snydell.
Good morning!
And we have Bill Graham.
Woo!
And as I said, we are here today to talk about Spider-Man Homecoming, the newest Marvel film. This one directed by John Watts, starring Tom Holland as the titular web-slinger, as well as Michael Keaton as his villainous foil. So before we get into that, however, gentlemen, how have we been? It's been maybe like 3 to 4 days since the last time we spoke with one another.
Yeah, I talked to you guys more than I talked to my mom.
Yeah, that's not wrong. It's, We have been spending more and more time with each other because of the crazy schedule that the last few weeks has done. And given that things like the Big Sick, the War of the Rising Dawn of the Planet of the Apes, and Dunkirk,
Ghost Story,
and A Ghost Story are all coming out in like the next 2 to 3 weeks, I can only imagine that we're going to keep it up.
Yeah, and to be honest with you, as long as they're as potentially good as that lineup is, I mean, for the most part, those are all going to be pretty darn good. Sorry for your hate for the apes, but yeah. But
that's the next one.
I was about to say, that's the perfect title for the next movie.
Hate of the apes. Yeah, but I mean, it's a good time to be a movie fan. It's just a shame that it's all like heavily situated towards the end of or the middle of July, and it's like, guys, we had like a whole summer blockbuster season where y'all produce absolute shit, and spread the wealth. So
for real, yo.
It's a good and a bad thing. I would much rather have all of these spread out every other weekend. So
yeah, well, unfortunately that is not to be the case, so you can look forward to a lot more of us, gentlemen. I can look forward to a lot more of you. Hooray. Yeah, you can follow us, if you want more of us, on Twitter, at Film Stage Show, Facebook, The Film Stage Show, and, of course, email us podcast@thefilmstage.com. Drop us a rating and a comment on iTunes. We got more ratings. No comments, though. And I believe the ratings were all good, because we haven't dropped it all. But who knows? Who can be sure? So give us a comment, and we can be sure to take whatever feedback you have and use it to influence the direction of the show going forward. Speaking of which, our Patreon page is still up and running. Patreon.com/thefilmstageshow. You will be given access to our Slack channel. You will be entered for sweet movie raffles that we have going on. For instance, this week you have the opportunity to win a brand new in the shrink wrap, non-previously owned by Jordan Raup DVD of Free Fire. I'm sorry, it's a Blu-ray of Free Fire. So if you would like the opportunity to win that, all you got to do is become a patron of ours for as little as $1 an episode, and you are automatically entered into all these great, great, great raffles we're doing. I feel like Jordan got real tired of us constantly breaking into his house, and so he like has bought a number of Blu-rays to serve as like an appeasement, a sort of like ritual sacrifice to keep us at bay. And I feel as though in the past this is how religions started. So we're taking our first step towards becoming a full-fledged religion, which is great.
We're way more of a cult than a religion, let's be honest, guys.
As a cult, we are going to call ourselves a religion, because that is the true mark of any cult.
Sure.
Even though we have very little religious dogma, and absolutely no altruistic sense of helping our greater man. We're still a religion. Give us money, and we'll continue to abuse Jordan Raup and spread his wealth amongst all of you.
So wait, again, people, we aren't just a religion.
Patreon.com/thefilmstageshow. We're also brought to you by Mubi. Mubi is the streaming online cinema where their curators select a new film every day for you to watch and enjoy. You have 30 days with that film before it disappears into the ether, so that means you have a constantly rotating selection of 30 films for your viewing enjoyment. We got a bunch of great stuff coming to Mubi in the days and the weeks ahead, and one of the ones that I am most interested about is Scarred Hearts from Romanian New Wave director Radu Jude, which is a follow-up to his award-winning Ephyrum. And
I reviewed that one.
How was it?
it's pretty interesting. I don't know if I loved it, but it's trying some things. Nice.
Yeah, so this is a colorful 35mm production shot in 4:3, which I don't know why, but I've been starting to pay more attention to the aspect ratios of the films I'm watching.
That's something I just still haven't been able to kind of figure out. I mean, there's certain ones, obviously the opening sequence of this film kind of plays with that. And then I'm trying to remember there was a movie a couple of years ago.
Grand Budapest Hotel?
No. Well, I mean, that one played with it as
Mommy.
Well. Yes, Mommy. That's what it was. And
also,
that was shot. Was that Messing with Perspective as well?
That was they changed the aspect ratio for the dream sequence.
That's right. Yeah.
Okay. See, yeah. I like those are such like subtle little touches that just really kind of are pleasing to the eye when you notice them.
Yeah,
I think.
No, I agree. So that's again why I'm looking forward to Scarred Hearts, which is described here as a delightful mix of melancholy and humor, which pretty much could count as a summation of my entire life. So it's something I'm looking forward to. So if you would like to check out this movie as well as all the other great stuff Mubi has to offer, all you have to do is go to mubi.com/filmstage and you will get a free 30-day trial of Mubi. So that is that. Gentlemen, any other thoughts, opinions, concepts, or ideas that we want to get to before we jump into Spider-Man Homecoming?
No, I'm good.
All right. Again, this is Spider-Man Homecoming. You know what? It's a Spider-Man movie. I'm going to play the trailer, and then we can talk about why this is such a particularly strange movie in terms of production when we get over the trailer.
Mm-hmm.
Finally, here we go.
Good evening, Peter.
Whoa!
You have 576 possible web shooter combinations.
That is awesome.
I can keep that suit?
Yeah, doesn't fit me.
So when's our next retreat?
What, next mission? We'll call you. All right.
That's not a hug, but I'm just grabbing the door for you.
We're not there yet.
All right, kid.
Good luck out there.
Hey, Peter. You coming tonight?
I can't tonight. I got the Stark internship.
What's up, guys?
Mr. Stark, here's my report.
Okay,
tonight.
So, all right, I'm gonna bust right through most of the basic shit about this movie's production. So, Spider-Man, owned by Sony, they did the 3 Sam Raimi movies, and then they did the 2 Mark Webb movies. Those did not go well. The Amazing Spider-Man series was, I think, financially successful, but creatively a disaster, and they showed no signs of improvement. Following the Sony hack, the people at Marvel and the people at Sony hacked out a deal wherein Spider-Man would be produced primarily by Marvel. Sony would handle production, distribution, so they would handle distribution and marketing, and Spider-Man is being shared, I believe, for 5 pictures, and the stable of villains kind of remains at Sony. So it's a very strange shared custody thing where Marvel Studios gets back one of its most famous people, the characters, to use in their films, and Sony gets the money and some of the glory and hopefully a boost to their stable of villains and side characters.
Yep.
For anyone who doesn't remember, there was going to be a Sinister Six series, which would include people like the Vulture, Doc Ock, and other people, the Rhino, I think. And
yes,
they were also going to do an Aunt May movie. This was the creative bankruptcy that led them to strike up a deal with Marvel. So Spider-Man appeared in Civil War and was received pretty well. And now this is his first solo outing. Here we have a film that takes place primarily in New York. Peter's in high school again, in the first Spider-Man film with Tobey Maguire. He was just graduating high school and going to college. And we have some of the Avengers lore and stuff touching down now and then. And we've got, you know, basic stuff. The movie was given to John Watts, a director who had previously done, I think, one other film called Cop Car.
Yes, it's good.
Okay, have not seen it. Hadn't really heard of it.
Yeah, didn't get around to it.
It may be on Netflix, apparently.
It might be.
He also apparently directed episodes of the Onion News Network and Onion Sports Dome. So he's got some comedy background, obviously. And, you know, basically your average story of white male independent filmmaker makes vaguely good film and is given an action franchise. So,
yeah.
Let's see.
A multi-million dollar action franchise. Like, yeah. Here you go, sir.
He also made a movie called Clown, which Eli Roth, I believe, was supposed to direct, but he dropped out and John Watts was the replacement, I believe. I don't quite know the whole production, but that was kind of a weird tidbit in his career.
So yeah, we have Tom Holland as Peter Parker / Spider-Man, Michael Keaton as Adrian Toomes / the Vulture. We also have Robert Downey Jr. dropped by now and then as Tony Stark, John Favreau as Happy Hogan, which is a terrible name. Marissa Tomei is Aunt May, and we've got a bunch of people who I'm sure are famous, but I don't know because they're too young, playing a bunch of different parts. For instance, Zendaya. I assume if you have one name, you're famous for something already. She is playing Michelle. And we have Laura Harrier as Liz. We have Tony Revel... Goddamn names. Revolori as Flash
Graham
Thompson.
Yes, he's so good. I love him.
Yeah, I guess we could... He's great in this. Anyway, so the story of this movie, not its production, but its actual plot, is that Peter Parker's in high school. He's just coming off the high of taking part in the mid-climactic battle of Civil War. And he's looking forward to doing more stuff with the Avengers.
Spoiler alert.
What was that?
Spoiler alert? I don't know.
No. That was in the trailers.
Oh, okay. All right. You're right. Okay.
Do you think the spoilers that he lived?
Okay. No. Come on. Let's go. God damn it.
So he's doing his spider thing. He wants Tony Stark to take him seriously. And then as he's doing all this stuff, a bunch of high-tech weapons are suddenly flooding the streets and he wants to find a way to stop them. So, that is the basics. We'll get into the specifics. But for now, gentlemen, what did you think on a very high level of Spider-Man Homecoming? Let's start with Bill Graham.
I gotta say, I was super pleased with this film. Man, the third act issues continue to plague just about every single comic book movie. This one really kind of devolves towards a major battle sequence, which I really don't know what the hell they were doing. I love the design of the suit. I love the design of the Vulture suit as well. I think that suit is really incredible. What this film does really well is it positions Peter Parker and kind of Spider-Man. They're obviously the same person. And yeah. Whoa!
Spoiler alert, Jesus.
Yeah, I know. But what it does is it positions him in a way that I believe he's supposed to be 15 or 16 in this film. And he makes mistakes after mistakes after mistakes. And he's trying to help, but a lot of times the direct cause or the direct result of him trying to help, especially when he starts to interfere with some of the bigger plot points in this film, they just go haywire, and he causes a lot of chaos and destruction because of that, because he doesn't know what he's doing, because he doesn't know how to handle these certain situations, and he can't get help. You know, that's kind of the struggle of the film, is he's kind of on his own dealing with some of these issues. And I love that it gives it consequences, and a lot of the consequences are directly because of his actions and his unfamiliarity with how to handle certain situations and things like that. He's constantly sneaking up on people and not necessarily getting the surprise that he thinks he is going to do. You know, he surprises them and then continues to fight them for like another 5 minutes. And it's like, well, if you had just like knocked them all out from the get-go, this wouldn't be an issue. And so he's always kind of like tinkering and trying to figure out how to both make an impression. I think he's always kind of trying to like impress, even though there's nobody necessarily watching. So it's this weird kind of melding of this character that really kind of feels very at one with the animated series that was so popular in the 90s, and also the comic book character as well. He's supposed to be immature. He's supposed to kind of go above and beyond what he ultimately is capable of and end up in over his head in a lot of situations. And this film does a really good job at doing that. I love the characters that populate this film. I love the twist on this film where Flash is now, instead of being a dumb jock, he is just a very, very smart kid that happens to also pester Peter Parker. And so it's all of these like little small twists and kind of tweaks, whether it's the color of the skin of various people in the film that populate it, things like that. This is a very, very diverse cast, and I appreciate John Watts, what he did with casting in this film. It's not something that he necessarily had to do, but you know, he's mentioned it specifically. This film is set in Queens. It's a very diverse place. Why the hell wouldn't I cast a bunch of diverse people? Especially early on, I really enjoyed a lot of the action sequences and a lot of the action beats. This film is definitely one of the funniest Spider-Man films I've seen in a while, but I think it's also just a tad bit long. It's got some surprises up its sleeves, and I'm trying to think. You know, Michael Keaton is absolutely fantastic in this film. I adored his character. I think the character motivations are pretty solid overall. I think he's got a kind of a monologue towards the end that I really kind of connected with. And I think overall this is a very, very pleasing outing. And holy shit, there is no mention of Uncle Ben ever. So bravo.
Yeah, fuck that dead guy. What did you think, again, very generally, of Spider-Man Homecoming?
Sure. Yeah, like Bill, I was pleasantly surprised. With one huge caveat I'll get into a little bit after saying the things I like. This is people have been really lazily comparing this to John Hughes. I think that's really off. I think this is something a lot more new and contemporary. Like, you know, I was honestly thinking of things more like American Pie and like early 2000s, like raunch comedies, mm-hmm. is what this reminded me a lot more of. And I think there is something back to basics about the understanding of superheroes that I really like in this. You know, like I am on the record as being a big fan of Guardians of the Galaxy 2, but that was one that felt very standalone. But what I like about this is it takes the themes of things like Avengers Age of Ultron, which was just, you know, this kind of unnecessarily dreary story about like casualties and loss and trauma. And this puts it in an entirely new perspective that makes it far more interesting. It's not a spoiler to say that literally the first scene of this movie is seeing one of the characters lose their job. And that being and that is kind of a thesis statement for this whole movie, mm-hmm. that the characters in this, you know, they are orbited by people who see the Avengers as like, you know, these big corporate entities. Like,
sure. Yeah.
So there's the corporate entities and the little guys. And I think this movie absolutely gets that right as far as those broad strokes themes. And then it really understands the high school stuff. Like the very fact that like part of this movie, like there's a Queen's bodega that there's a scene in, like, and there are, you know, at the high school, there's a bad news show. There's like so many little details. Touches. Yeah. And Bill, I'm sorry, but did you want to say something, Bill?
No. It's just so good. Like there's a sequence in a principal's office where you can see off to the side, up against a wall, for no reason whatsoever except to just give like little character detail. It's a picture of like his grandfather or something like that in like army dress.
Yeah, that's actually okay. So
that's right.
I noticed that, and I was like, this is so obvious that it has to be a callback to something. His mm-hmm. grandfather was one of the Howling Commandos in the first Avenger.
Oh my God.
Guys, like there's just so much of that little shit that populates this film. There's a sequence where
shit in fucking every okay, I'm sorry. Obviously my anger is going to tip my hand a bit.
I'm not done yet. Guys.
Yeah. There's a lot of that in every movie. Like if you're a big enough nerd sure. about this stuff, you can see this in every Marvel film. But anyway, Michael Snydell, please continue with, again, general thoughts we're still on.
Sure. This is
Spider-Man Homecoming.
It's not fan service I like. It's a general sense that I feel like this is a connected world that they thought about as more than just flavor. Like the very fact that the orbit of people around him, from love interests to bullies, are all part of the same academic decathlon with him, says a lot about how much they thought about this movie. And I think the villain mostly gets across that same grounded thing. Now I can get into the thing. So it is a testament to how much I liked the high school and the comedy stuff that I hated every action scene in this movie from top to bottom. And I'm still trying to pinpoint what I did this. I saw this late at last night, what the difference is. I'll just go briefly. There is a new cinematographer who has not previously worked with this house style. There is a new editor. But I'm not going to only blame it on – I'm not going to say it's that. But there is – every moment of the action in this movie, the only thing I think it gets right is that I can potentially believe Thomas Howland is at times in that suit, just because when it's not the action scenes, he has such a limberness and a physicality.
Did you call
that
him Thomas
is,
Howland?
Yeah.
Isn't it Thomas? Oh, shoot.
Tom.
I'm sorry.
It's guys. Tom Holland.
I'm sorry. All right, Tom Holland has a physicality and limberness.
First time we've ever lengthened an actor's name on this show.
What?
Mikey Keats, yeah? Robbie Brown, and we got Thomas Holland.
Man, every scene of action was so unmoored from the rest of this movie, and it's a variety of things. It's one that it shot up so close. So the third act is just it's a disaster as far as that action scene goes. But even early on, there were many times where I literally had no idea what was going on. I'm not saying this isn't just a Marvel thing. I really didn't like Civil War very much as far as action scenes either. But this one just totally lacked even that basic grammar that made it fun for me to watch. And there's a weird blandness to how they approach Spider-Man in the action scenes. And I say that, and I'm still positive about this movie because I like all of the other stuff. But damn it, we need either a new director or a new choreographer, or there needs to be a revision of how we approach action in Marvel movies, because this was just ridiculous. Like, it is among, it is up there with Thor 2 for the worst action in a Marvel movie for me. So yeah, the characters are great. I want to spend more time with these people. Holland's great. Keaton's pretty good. Even his best friend is great. And Zendaya, who I've never heard of before, is someone who makes these disposable scenes that should be nothing into something that just feels really, just there's a lot of stuff I like in this movie, but damn it, I'm kind of tired of Marvel, guys.
Yeah, I mean,
go ahead.
So, like, you know, Marvel. Like, I wrote a review on Letterboxd to this movie, and I was like, you know, Marvel films are like McDonald's. They're only ever interesting or fun to talk about when they really screw something up. Like, if you walk up to someone and they're like, hey man, what'd you do for lunch? And you said, I went to this new bistro down the street. It's like a French Indian fusion place. They'd be like, oh crap, what is that like? Tell me more. And if you walk up to them and they say, what'd you have for lunch? And you say, I had McDonald's, they'd just say, oh. Because everyone knows what that means. It means that you didn't have any better options and you got something and it was fine and you're no longer hungry. Now, the inverse of that is, I went to McDonald's, there was a human foot in my sandwich. And then when I pointed it out to the person behind the register, they tried to punch me in the mouth. That's an interesting story because something went very wrong, and it's more interesting to talk about it because it went wrong. When everything at McDonald's goes right, it's an invisible, gray, flavorless nothing that is only there to get you on to the point where you can get something better. And that is exactly what Marvel films are becoming. And I don't know why it's this film that really broke me in that way, because I've found good things to say about, like, Civil War and The Winter Soldier, and I'm sure there was another one. I had good things to say about Ant-Man. But, like, this movie has less personality than Ant-Man.
What?
Its characters are less fun and interesting than Ant-Man, with the exclusion of, like, Zendaya, who has, like, 7 lines, and 6 of them are great. And then the final one is crazy making. And I just, like, I don't have a lot to say about this movie because it's fine. It opens with a spoon song as a child walks into a high school, which is the least creative or interesting thing that you could ever do.
You didn't name the song, too.
Oh, it's Underdog. But the funny thing is, they don't even have the lyrics playing. So
sure.
it's a deep cut insofar as they use the incredibly catchy music with the title, but they don't use the lyrics where the guy sings about it, people being an underdog. And it's just, you know, like, I just don't give a fuck. Like, he wants to be an Avenger. Who cares? Like, I don't give a shit about that ambition. That's a shitty ambition. Yeah. Give a character a better ambition. Like,
yeah.
I don't want another fucking Avenger. I don't want another Avengers movie.
Yeah. They edge towards making Tony Stark interesting by making him a legitimate asshole and then back off because they're like, oh, wait, he's one of our cardinal, you know, talents. Like, it's so weird that this movie, like, plays like, oh no, the Avengers are really bad people and not interesting people.
But then
it realizes it's also part of that same fucking series.
Right. So here's my thing. Like, if I still gave this movie 3 stars, which is a recommendation in my mind. It's just like, I don't, there's not a on the star scale, it's like,
There's not a Marvel star scale.
Right. There's not like between 3 and 3.5 stars, like an asterisk star that's just like, it's a Marvel film. You know what you're getting. You're going to like it no matter what. It's like if it's a perfectly temperate, windless day and like you stand outside and it's not particularly sunny, but it's not overly overcast. And it's just, it's not one of those days where you're like, God, it looks terrible out, or it's so beautiful out, we got to do something outside. It's one of those days where, like, you have a bunch of shit to do, and you're not going to be miserable the 5 minutes that you're walking from your car to, like, the grocery store. Like, that's the kind of movie that this is. It's just that shitty middle day that doesn't grant you anything and doesn't really take anything from you, except when there's an action scene, and then it's like a flock of birds over and shit on you. So, I just don't know. Like, I don't know what to say about this movie, because anything I say beyond it's fine is going to be finding problems with it, which is going to make me seem more negative than I am, because at the end of the day, it's a serviceable product for the people who would want this product.
Mm-hmm.
And that's me. What you're going to get. And I don't think that it particularly does anything well. I don't think that it really shits the bed anywhere. I think mm-hmm. that it's got too many side plots. I think that
yes.
the best scene is probably like the one that takes place in Maryland/Washington. But the whole movie could have been done without that scene.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, you know, I just like, it's, I have like no choice but to seem negative, because I can make myself angry at the small problems in a movie, but I can't make myself effusively positive about its competent left-right trot towards the fucking ending and the next movie in this series. Like, I just can't.
Yeah.
I can't do it. I just, I've lost the ability to. Wonder Woman had the interesting setting and the social aspect of a first, like, the first major female superhero film that we've gotten since the ugly 1-2 punch of Catwoman and Elektra. And it was good. Like, that was a good thing. And then it also had Chris Pine and Gal Gadot in it. And
yeah, this film desperately needs... desperately needs somebody like that.
Yeah, it does. Because everyone else in it is there's no time for any of them. Like, my favorite part was Donald Glover.
Yeah, he's so fantastic in this movie.
And it just kind of really made me think, like, you know, God, I wish he had been Spider-Man.
Yeah. Do you, though?
It got close.
Yeah, because he's...
It got close.
Yeah, like he. The funny thing is, Troy Barnes in Community is
more close
to my conception of what Spider-Man is than any like cinematic Spider-Man.
He's
like a delightful nerd.
Troy is a little bit more like almost on the scale, though.
On the spectrum or on the scale?
Oh, spectrum. Sorry.
Okay. Yeah. Now here's the thing. Like, I have friends who love Spider-Man. Like, I have mm-hmm. friends who like Batman and Superman. But I have friends who have, like, a weird personal connection to Spider-Man. One of them mm-hmm. so much so that he, with the coming this movie coming out, was tapped by The Hollywood Reporter to write an entire article about his relationship with Spider-Man. Because he runs a Spider-Man podcast. Like, Spider-Man is super important to some people.
Oh, yeah. Dan Gavostin?
Yeah, he's been on this podcast, actually.
Yeah.
Spider-Man is super important to some people, and I get that. He's never been important to me. And
I can understand why. I understand why a lot of people kind of are drawn to him, because most of his iterations are high schoolers. Yeah. Most of his iterations are kind of struggling with, you know, trying to find love amidst having a bully, amidst having all of these other things kind of going on in your life. And, you know, it is a very unique character that has stuck around, insofar as so many of our superheroes are just grown ass fucking adults. And Spider-Man again and again and again is placed back into high school. And for with three iterations of this thing within the last 10 years, that becomes a little tough to swallow. But just the same, I can understand why a lot of younger people, when they're reading comics, connect to him and continue to connect to him throughout his kind of run and everything like that. Right. It makes sense. Mm-hmm.
And so I have no investment in this character. I mm-hmm. have nothing riding on him or his success. And I have different variations of him that I like. There's a cartoon called The Spectacular Spider-Man,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
which I watched with my nephew, who was like 9. No, he's 10 now. He was probably like 6 at the time. And I thought, wow, this is a really good cartoon. It took Spider-Man. It put him in high school at like the Midtown Science mm-hmm. and Technology. Whatever.
Yeah, I've seen this one. Yeah, I've seen some episodes.
And he's a kid, and he's constantly working with teachers and other students. And oftentimes, the problems that are being faced are stand-ins for problems that a high schooler would have. For instance, there's an episode, I'm pulling this from memory, so apologies if I get any of the plot wrong. There's an episode where, like, one of his friends is using, like, the Green Goblin juice to be better at sports because he wants to be popular, and it's also, you know, but then that turns him into the Green Goblin. He's a villain every now and then. Like, it takes over, and he becomes a villain, and Spider-Man's got to fight him. And so Spider-Man has to deal with being Peter Parker and trying to make his friend basically stop doing drugs and also be Spider-Man and stop a villain from destroying everything. And it's stuff like that that I feel like is perfectly suited to Spider-Man. To take these incidents and events and problems that a child or a teenager might have to deal with and to give them the operatic weight of a superhero film. And instead, in this movie, we've got a bunch of faceless thugs using glowy weapons to lift up shit, and Spider-Man's trying to stop them. Like, it's just, it's not interesting, it's not clever, it's not fun.
No, it is way more interesting than other ones, because this is not the same as faceless thugs. We have seen them as blue-collar workers. Like, I'm going to fight you on that a little bit. I will agree that there is a product, that this is very much a product. Like, it was right around that same time where they're talking about where the underdog came on. I'm like, Jesus fucking Christ. And then about the time where he swings and it's an obvious homage to a movie, which then they fucking show a scene from.
Yeah.
Which, like, those are huge cringeworthy moments. But that is not fair to say that this is these are faceless thugs. Like, this movie tries.
The people in that ATM are literally faceless. They are wearing masks.
But it is connected to something. I will get into that into spoilers, but there is context there for why that robbery would matter to him and to the people around him.
Yeah.
Like, I will say that there...
Does that give the thugs faces?
This is... Wait, Brent. What I want to say, though, is it's like, it's not... I see where you're... I would even agree with you for almost any other superhero movie, but, like, this movie, it doesn't always succeed, but it absolutely tries to put a face to all these people and to make them normal people. It's not
I agree. Possible, I agree.
But, like, it is not fair to say that this is another, like Avengers Age of Ultron, that is a dog shit movie where I care about none of the people who are dying. When people die in this movie, we might not get quite enough time with them, but we are absolutely getting them in their day-to-day. And we will get in. There's one, obviously, the most, like, pivotal thing we can get into later. But, like, I'm sorry, man. I would absolutely go to bat with you for, like, this being a Marvel paint by numbers. And there are bits of that. But, like, there is a lot more going on here. Like, this feels far more thought out than any recent Marvel movie. Like, this is way more thematically cohesive than Doctor Strange, for instance. By the way, way, way less interesting.
I will say, I've seen every Marvel film except for Doctor Strange, so I can't say if that's worse or better. I'm just throwing that out there.
Okay, I'm just saying, like, you throwing this out here, it feels easy, Brian, in a way you don't do. And I'm just like, I'd like you to actually get into this stuff because I think you did take the easy way out here. It's fine if you didn't like the movie, but you can't quite toss this aside the same way you can. If you want to talk about not spending enough time with these characters, that is something else. But to say that they are faceless, like, is entirely counterintuitive to the actual approach of this movie, which you can say that works or not. But, like, if anything, this movie tries to be a counter to that exact idea.
I would say that you're right insofar as, like, the villain and, like, two of his henchmen have faces, but again, the ATM scene, the inciting incident of this movie is faceless thugs with glowy weapons. Now, their victims may not be faceless, but they are just bank robbers with glowy weapons.
Well, there's like one sequence with that, and then from that point on, it's mainly he butts up against henchmen, and the henchmen you know.
Okay, whatever. I don't care enough to argue. I mean, like, it's There's a, okay, well, we have to get into spoilers for me to talk about your whole blue collar thing. But no, I just like I don't think this is nearly as like meaningful or thought out or impactful as you're making it. I think that it gives lip service to that. But
Brent, I'm not saying it's a great movie. I also gave it 3 stars, but like the way you're going in on it.
Okay. Well,
I'm going in on it in the way it deserves to go in on, because there's not enough to take it from any other angle. It's a simple, it's a very simple movie. Like it doesn't rock any boats, except I'm certain that like a certain population of the internet is going to get pissed off about something. But that's not what we're talking about. I just it, like aside from like a couple of tossed off lines, it holds a veneer of having some sort of social or societal statement. But in the end, there's a lot of explosions and poorly choreographed action and glowing stuff.
That's 100% agreement there.
Yeah.
Well, I mean that's all of these movies though, isn't right. it? Like at a certain point. I understand that's the problem, but it doesn't help me to just continue to point out the issue. I want to see what they're doing specifically different here, and I think they are doing enough different here that it's not just, you know, it devolves into that, but they do a good job of setting up enough to where it's a little bit different. It feels a little bit different. I'm definitely much more connected to these characters than any of the characters in Doctor Strange, and I enjoyed Doctor Strange. Sure. So, you know, it is what it is. I'm not sure if it's just specifically because it's the high school setting. I'm not sure if it's just because it's the actors in it. You know, I recognized a lot more of these actors than I probably should have. It kind of freaked me out when I started to recognize Bokeem Woodbine and Logan Marshall Green
and I recognize
so many of these people, and I'm just like, what is going on? I didn't realize half of these people were cast in this film, and it's blowing my mind because even small little characters are fleshed out by actors that I really enjoy in some of their other things. And I'm not sure if that's like forward thinking by John Watts or if that's just who he likes working with or what that is, but I was thoroughly impressed with the cast that was put together for this film, and I think they do a good job of fleshing out characters that would otherwise be so meaningless and so small. So it's one of those weird kind of meta things where you recognize actors, right? And you immediately have an attachment to them, even if their character is shittily written. Like, it doesn't matter because I recognize that person, and automatically I'm giving them more kind of emphasis and kind of weight.
Yeah, that's fair.
So it's weird. It's weird. It's a weird situation. So we need to get into spoilers.
Yeah, we do.
I guess we do. God,
I'm tired.
Again, I'm sounding so much more negative because like there's so I don't want to be like, hey, they got him in the frame every time. Like, that's the level of congratulations that this movie deserves.
Ryan,
like,
it's come on.
Yeah.
There's like nothing it's, particularly good
hey, look,
about this
look.
Movie.
I'm just gonna say, okay. That's Brian.
All right, guys, good podcast. Brian, come on, man. What? We are here to talk for an hour. Maybe not an hour. We are here to talk about this. You can't like.
Because we have to fill the time, I have to be negative. Like,
I want to clarify. The possibility that we're going to have to do multiple of these for every year of my life, like, makes me really just kind of want to jump out my window. But
at a certain point, we're going to have to start, like, just not covering them.
We are going to have to winnow down it a little bit. Yeah. But
it's like if a music review place started reviewing every new, like, commercial jingle. Like, it just doesn't make any sense because that's not the point. They're not here to make an artistic statement. So, like, why are we treating them like they are?
But that is, we can talk about, we have talked a lot about like the monolith of studio, you know, imperatives and things like that. But like, if we're not even going to give it the chance to even, as Bill says, point out what is actually different here. And if you really think that, Brian, I think that you made up your mind walking in. Like, you can say you don't.
Lazily making an argument. Congratulations, you just made the laziest one that you can possibly make.
All right, you're right. The point being that, like, if we're even going to talk about this, there's no point in literally ending at.
Okay.
I don't fucking know. I hate blockbusters. We gotta stop doing this.
Well, let's get into spoilers, and we can talk about like the one interesting idea in this movie that then doesn't really lead to anything. So throughout the movie, oh yeah, we're in spoilers now, by the way. Spoilers. So throughout the movie, Peter is chasing this guy in a vulture suit, I guess is the best way to put it. And he finally sees his face during a weapons deal that happens on a ferry. Spider-Man accidentally fucks up an FBI bust, which is something that doesn't lead to any consequences for him from a like legal standpoint. But Tony Stark does take away his suit and then gives him a hilariously oversized tourist shirt. And then so he kind of is like, you know what, fuck it, I'm not going to do this anymore. And he asks out Liz, who is his the girl that he has a crush on.
High school crush. Yep.
Yeah. She's boring as hell.
She's boring as hell.
I guess. I don't know. Jesus. Wow.
She's kind of boring. She is what she is.
Like, you know, she is what she is.
Next to like,
she's a Tony device.
Valori doing his thing. I mean, like, everyone's boring in this movie.
Yes. I love Tony.
He was an excellent
I think his best friend is great, Jacob Batacon.
He walks a very thin line, and I think that he nails it. Because he has to be goofy and like sort of a foil for things going poorly now and then, but he also just like seems like a very decent human being who wants to do
this porn joke lands.
Yeah, he has good comic timing in that way. So he goes to Homecoming with Liz, and it turns out that Michael Keaton is her father,
which was a huge mic drop for me and my friend. I didn't see that coming at all. I don't know if y'all saw that coming, but
I did not see it coming until he was parked outside with Aunt May,
and it kind of, you could feel the tension start to rise a little bit.
It wasn't even the tension. I was just like, we have to wrap this fucking movie up somehow, right? Like, what are they going to do? Are they going to make him like her father? Because I started thinking like, oh, we haven't seen her parents yet. We're finally going to. Oh. Yeah.
It was during this sequence when I started to feel the length of the film, when he's revealed and they're driving over to the homecoming dance. The sequence is fantastic, but it started to make me realize how much more of this film we were going to get. And I was like, haven't we been here for 2 hours now? And no, we had only been there for like an hour and a half to like an hour and 45 minutes. And there was still like another 30 minutes for this film to go.
And that's one of my, as I was watching this movie, Bill, I had that same thought. I was like, I feel like I've been through 2 months of this kid's life.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, wouldn't it be more interesting if like it was literally the day of homecoming was just the whole movie. And we open, like, maybe the night before, where he's trying to break up, like, an arms deal, and he sees this guy, and he's like, you know, this friggin' vulture, I've been trying to stop him for, like, months now, but I don't know who he is, and I don't know what's happening, and I haven't been able to get a hold of him. And then, like, maybe Ned, who already knows that he's Spider-Man, is like, man, it's homecoming, like, just put it away, you stopped the arms deal, that's what's important, you finally got the balls to ask Liz out, you're going out tonight. And then, like, and then you could, like, honestly give like a first act twist when he goes to pick up Liz for homecoming that her father's the vulture. And then you can really spend your time in that car and in everything that follows. And it just like, I just want like that to me would be an interesting different choice, is to do
an hour and a half version. Yeah,
and to do a superhero movie that takes place all in the same day, like that just gets the story like nailed down to a period of 24 hours, and then tells it tightly and interestingly, and doesn't have to like take a trip to Washington in the middle, and doesn't.
Yeah, I don't know why that Washington trip happens at all. You know, I mean, we get some interesting sequences out of it, but it's just like, man, and the whole like, I understand the training wheels thing with the suit, and I enjoyed that aspect, but they really don't do a whole lot of any consequence throughout that film, except just kind of adding little funny touches, and I enjoy those funny touches, but I'm like, man, you spent like two or three sequences, like action beats, setting up the suit and doing absolutely nothing with it. Like it just doesn't, I guess what it does is it shows how much more tech is built into the suit than his normal suit. It's not just web slingers and things like that. It's got its own AI, and you know, but it starts to become Tony's suit, and I don't want Spider-Man's suit to be Tony's suit. That doesn't make any sense.
I was going to ask, you know, controversial opinion. I fucking hate his suit in this movie. How does everyone else feel?
Like even like the final suit that Tony tries to put him in, I was like, that's an Iron Man suit. Like, you can't have him. Like, it looked like it was made out of metal. I was like, no.
I read an article that said that the suit was an homage to something called like the Iron Spider, which apparently is something that Tony made for Spider-Man in the Civil War comics. I don't know. I don't know enough about this shit. I should have asked Dan Gavazdin to be on. But especially when like the AI of his suit is unleashed, I was like, wow, I really hate this. Like, I'm cool with his suit having a couple things now and then, like early on in the movie, he's got a couple of doodads and gadgets.
Sure. But
like when that woman's voice comes on and he's got like 500 and however odd combinations.
Yeah, 568 or something like that. Yeah. It's just like Jesus.
And he's got like a voice modulator.
Yeah. I was
like, you know, like even at the worst moments of Amazing Spider-Man, whichever one of those movies you want, you know, he was just a kid in a suit. And that's where his power comes from. Like, his power is he's just a kid who wants to do the right thing and happens to have a very specific set of abilities that allow him to do that.
And there's a very iffy sense of where his powers end and where that suit begins.
Yeah.
And
I think that they make a smart decision.
Going back to the original.
Yeah, to his hoodie.
Yeah.
But the problem is we've never known him.
Yeah,
in his hoodie.
Sure.
It is a smart choice to kind of take the tools away, because then what we end up seeing is kind of his own abilities inside his kind of hoodie suit, and that's nice. The idea behind the AI suit was just so much. It just reminded me so much of Tony Stark, and the common. Amongst comic book fans, the common like criticism of Tony Stark is that he doesn't have any actual abilities. He's got a suit.
Right.
That's
he is like
Batman. Batman is a fantastic detective. He's a fantastic fighter. He's got all of these other things that he has, and his tools and gadgets are part of that.
Right.
But he's still a man in a suit.
You know, Iron Man in these movies is basically if Lucius Fox from the Dark Knight trilogy like decided, you know what, I could do it too.
Yeah, yeah. You know, and they kind of do that with like War Machine. You know, they throw what's his face into the War Machine suit, and you're like, oh, okay, so anybody can just step into this
Don
damn
Cheadle?
Thing. And, yeah, Don Cheadle. It's like anybody can just step into this
not
damn thing,
Howard.
And yes, not money dispute. Anyways, yeah, so
you know, it's one of those things. It's just like, I don't want to see him in a suit. That's not Spider-Man. That's not what I want. I want him to be able to, you know, like the web slingers and things like that. I like that they play with it because it's obviously not coming out of his hands, which is, you know, just a very weird thing. You know, it is what it is. So, yeah, I didn't like the design of the AI suit at all.
But you know, like, luckily they get rid of that. And then we have the ending where he. Okay, I have to ask a question real quick.
Sure.
So when he's fighting the Shocker, out in the school bus yard. Got to be a better way to say that. He says, "Why did he even send you here?" And then the guy says something like, "I guess you'll never know," or like, "Wouldn't you like to know?"
Yeah, I was wondering about that as well.
Know.
Yeah. He says that, and you're like, wait, is that supposed to be a reveal? Are you not supposed to be there?
Are they like covering up the fact that it makes no sense that this guy would know which exit to look for Peter at?
I don't know. Well, like, he also had gone to that high school before, right?
I guess, yeah.
But there is also that Keaton's character was very much like expecting him when he does arrive.
I think he only really figures it out in the car.
No, I know. But what I'm saying is, sure. But then he sets Shocker to go to that exit. I mean, I don't think he was absolutely sure that Peter would run into Shocker.
Yeah, but I guess so. Shocker's like
just supposed to stay on patrol.
He lives five minutes from that school, and he's like, "Hey, man, I just dropped Spider-Man off there. Can you make sure that he doesn't like come out after me?"
By the way, is it a really, really long ride from Queens to Maryland?
Oh, I make that ride every Thanksgiving. It is, it can be about 4 hours.
What, is that what he's doing every day then? Keaton's character, because
I think that they were only there for that one specific shipment that was happening.
Yep. Oh, yeah, all right.
It seems right. Like, because the whole deal is that Toombs's group...
Just call him Vulture.
I don't want to call him Vulture. Okay, you know what? Fine. This is another funny thing. So, like, I think in the comics, the Vulture is, like, a scientist that works for Oscorp.
Yes.
Because, like, everyone works
for
Oscorp.
Yeah. This is very true. You have nailed the Spider Universe down to a T with that comment. So, yeah, so everybody works for Oscorp.
I think it's the first episode of The Spectacular Spider-Man. Because like the Vulture's kind of a dumb character when you get down to it.
Sure.
I think they do a lot to rationalize him and his being in this movie. But in The Spectacular Spider-Man, he's like an old scientist, and Osborn is like, "I'm making cuts and you're gone." And the guy's like, "You can't fire me, like I've been here for 40 years." And Osborn says, "You know, like, get out of here, you, like, dumb old buzzard or something," because the guy looks like a buzzard. And then he comes in his wingsuit, like, the next day, and he's like, "You know, you called me a Vulture, and so that's what I became.
Sure.
I'm the Vulture." And Osborn is like, "I called you a buzzard, you moron. You can't even get the insult I used on you yet."
Yeah.
Yeah.
And in the comics... a lot of it is, or at least in the animated series from 94, it's he regenerates his youth by basically sucking the energy out of other people. And so he flies around in a suit as an old guy, and then he'll land and then he'll become, you know, hyper masculine. Yeah.
I can't decide if that's really dumb or not.
I don't know. He's a Vulture. He feeds off of others. And in this movie, you know, he's feeding off of the destruction of
I do like all of that. The technology, the use of it. I love that his character becomes an entrepreneur in a lot of ways. He was, in a way, an entrepreneur to begin with because he was salvaging all of these things and like nobody wanted it. So he was taking it out. And, you know, but he sees a niche and he's like, "Wow, all of this tech. My buddy over here can do some interesting things with it. Why don't we just
stealer.
yeah, why don't we do something fun? And his point about Tony Stark being an arms dealer is absolutely spot on, perfect, especially in this universe that they've created, because Tony went through a lot of those kind of emotional feelings of, I made my fortune, my dad made his fortune off of selling weapons, like weapons of mass destruction. And, you know, sometimes it got sold to the wrong people, you know, who is, sure. You know, and in this kind of modern time, it's like, who is the wrong people? The people that you're fighting against, you know, it's like, sure. Well, they don't view it that way, you know? So there's always that kind of interesting question. And so in this, I love that he's like, look, I'm not Tony Stark. I don't have that name. And I'm selling these weapons and I'm making a lot of money, but, you know, all of a sudden you're going to call me a criminal, but not Tony Stark. And
I know what you're talking about, Bill. And I like all that. Like, it makes sense that he would do that way. And he gets a start after the first Avengers movie. And I was going to say, the reason that he's getting that stuff from Maryland is because it's near DC, and DC was where the Winter Soldier final battle happened. They make a point of mentioning the Triskelion, which, like,
what the fuck is that?
That's the building that collapsed. The Harrier jets? No, the flying
hover jets.
Aircraft carriers. The banana.
The hover carrier. Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
We don't know what the fuck we're talking about.
But if you don't remember what the word Triskelion means, you're like, oh, is that what the aliens were called? No, that's the
Chitauri.
Whatever. Yeah, anyway, so make sure you bring your Marvel dictionary with you. So yeah, that's why he's doing that. But like, he seems to be going all over the world and stealing shit. Like, at some point they talk about getting some salvage from Sokovia, where all the Ultron bots died. So
I think mainly he's getting most of this tech from the Chitauri and from a lot of the creatures that kind of got taken down. You know, because that seems
a bunch of it is, yeah.
But yeah, like, it's the purple stuff. It's the purple stuff.
Shield was using those things to make weapons as well. So anytime a shield craft goes down, but now I don't think Shield exists anymore. Doesn't matter.
Yep, they do not.
what I was gonna say is, I'm tired of everything coming back to Tony Stark.
Agreed.
Yeah.
He is the most important.
He is the Logan. He is the Logan of this comic book universe for sure.
Like, Logan is,
are they killing him though?
I don't want this. And Tony Stark's like, bring it on, motherfucker. But not in an interesting way. More like a, I'm so rich and handsome, it doesn't matter, nothing can touch me.
But then is like really annoyingly sacrimonious about, you know, about how he is trying to, you know, teach lessons and that he, you know, is flawed as well. Like, that's what makes me super annoyed. Like, I would find him more interesting if he was kind of an unrepentant asshole without even a speck of like altruism to him. But just that little bit.
You mean Dr.
that was
Strange?
Supposed. No. All right.
Because that's basically Dr. Strange.
I know.
He's just a huge dick.
I like Doctor Strange far more than Tony Stark.
Sure.
But even though I wouldn't say I found him more interesting because he's not really that interesting. But yeah, that's my point.
let's jump into something real quick.
So just to wrap up the movie, he stops him. The guy is gonna steal stuff from an airplane, or steal the whole airplane that Tony Stark is like shipping away. And, you know, it'd be bad because he'd be able to make more weapons and stuff.
He would also have a lot of tech that he doesn't necessarily have, you know, the ability to recreate. A lot of it would be Tony Stark kind of tech.
Yeah,
and
like
so he would be able
to create of the arc reactors.
That would be really bad news. Like, I think they mentioned something about Thor's like belt at some point Favreau? I'm not sure because it sounded like they were trying to say Mjolnir at first, but they definitely say Thor's belt and not Thor's hammer. Yeah. Because the other thing is, Thor's hammer would definitely be with Thor. Like
you can't lift it. Just, you know,
yeah,
like,
you can't lift it, so that plane wouldn't be going very far.
Maybe his belt has a name too. You know, the Norse were fond of naming everything. Yeah. So anyway, he brings down the plane, saves the day. He saves Tombs after his wing pack explodes, and so then he's like, "I saved you, and everything's cool." And Tombs is like, "All right, I get it, bro." And there's some post-credit sequences, one of which is a guy who I don't remember where I saw him.
Scorpion.
Does anyone remember where this guy with the broken arm came from?
He's the person who's buying on the ferry.
Oh, yep. The one that was holding onto the back?
Yeah.
Okay,
Nacho.
Great. Yes.
Yeah, Nacho.
Yes. From Better Call Saul.
Yeah.
Okay. So, yeah, Nacho from Better Call Saul is like, you know, I don't blame you for this. I blame the Spider-Man, and I know some people outside who want to fuck him up, and I know that I've heard rumors that you know who he is, and Tombs is like, if I did, don't you think he'd be dead already, and walks away. So apparently we have another
set
villain, another father figure who respects Peter so much that he's going to keep his identity safe.
Maybe. We'll see.
There's a lot of Osborn and Keaton's character, and not the least being that when he tries to entomb Peter, that looks like the fucking Green Goblin flyer when it's like the foundation.
Yeah, the glider. Yeah, the glider. Yep.
I was like, wait, am I watching a different movie?
Does this Spider-Man not have spider sense?
I guess not.
I guess, yeah.
We don't see his like quick reaction to things before they happen.
Like a bunch of shit catches him by surprise, and I was like, "Where is your spider? Why isn't your spider sense tingling, Spidey?"
Yeah, they kind of do away with. I mean, he's obviously very strong. He's obviously very agile, but I'm just not sure. Mm-hmm. Where he's getting most of his stuff. They talk about the spider a little bit, but he kind of brushes it off. And I was just like, wait, so did he not get bit by us? I don't understand what's going on here. Like, so
he got bit by a spider. Cause his friend is like, can I get bit by the spider? Did it hurt? And, but yeah, like, you know, we're back to the classical thing where he has web shooters, not organic webs, which is fine with me. I never had an opinion on that either way. Mm-hmm. But like, yeah, you know, he can jump high, and I'm pretty, you know, he can climb everything. But I really do feel like that fucking suit like makes his innate Spider-Manism harder to suss out from everything else. Because he's got the GPS basically creating for him like routes to shoot and take.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, I don't know, it just kind of bugged me. Like, bugged.
He is an arachnid. Yes,
Very fair.
Paused. You were like, wait. Yeah.
Oh, boy.
We're so good.
Hashtag things that arachnid me about Spider-Man Homecoming.
I do want to mention that it's the sequence on the plane when the vulture starts to attack him while they're like on top of the plane and they're like fighting each other. I will go to bat for a lot of action sequences in the Marvel films. Even the ones in Civil War, I watched that film 3 or 4 times in theaters. I enjoyed the action sequences in there. Yes, they are chaotic, but I could take
like
measure
opening
of them.
That opening scene where like the Black Widow and Captain America are fighting, people were like, it's too choppy. And I was like, actually, I could follow it really well.
Exactly. Sure. Thank you.
Yeah,
yes.
Not the case in this movie.
No, that sequence on that plane. Oh, my God. I was looking at it and I literally looked away from the screen. I was like, I can't handle this anymore. I can't understand what's going on. I don't understand why they decided to make a cloaking plane and then try and weave that into that action sequence, because every single time the vulture would like hit the plane with his wings, it would knock up all of these like panels, and the panels were making like bright flashes, and then the like reaction of the wings going into the plane itself was making a bright reaction, and everything was just like a pop of flash. And I was just like,
I didn't really understand that.
The sound design in that scene too is just so abrasive.
That And that sequence lasts like a good like minute and a half, 90 yeah. seconds or so. And you're just like, this entire sequence sucks. Like, it's terrible. There are some other sequences. Like, I noticed when Peter is like running on buildings, when he's chasing the two henchmen and he's running on like rooftops and things like that. A lot of that stuff looked really kind of janky and looked. Yeah, early CGI.
A lot of the CGI in this movie did not look as good as the CGI in Spider-Man 2.
Yeah, I agree.
Like, not even the Amazing Spider-Man 2, just Sam Raimi's Spider-Man 2.
Well, I really think that's the cinematographer and a new director here and a new editor. Like, the combination of all those things and the fact that the blocking is so close up. It's okay to do wide shots, I swear.
Like, that scene on the plane is crying out for a wide shot where you see the whole plane tearing apart around them and you see Spider-Man, like, backing up as the vulture's wings come down at him. Like, and all of it, and you just see Spider-Man rolling to the side before, like, a mini explosion happens, and then you see Michael Keaton's glowing eyes with, like, shit on the sides of his face because his wings are doing stuff. It's like, it's not, I don't know who, that was probably all CGI, and I don't know why during the course of, like, storyboarding it, they were like, hey, does anyone else notice this looks like shit? And what's crazy also is, like,
Someone spent a year and a half on that.
Yeah.
That's the saddest thing I've ever heard. The scene where Peter asks out Liz is equally terrible in terms of
the,
like,
blocking of that is
blocking
really
and
weird.
Shots. Yep. And, like,
I do love the size of his hall pass, though. I was watching it with my friend who's a former teacher, and we just both looked at each other when we noticed the size of the hall pass, and we just died laughing because, like, it's
funny.
Like, there are some subtle, small detail, or I mean, that's not even subtle, but there's those, like, little small comedic things that I love that add up to a lot in this film. But
gum under the seats during that action scene.
The gum under the seats. The action scenes. I wish the action scenes had six writers as well. Like, like, please, like, but Jesus.
But like I was saying, like, the goddamn. Like, the blocking in that scene is terrible. Like, they're both, for whatever reason, not looking at each other. The camera is in, like, hyper close up, and you never really see them together until it's over.
Yeah,
and then you finally get, like, a mid shot of him, like, awkwardly walking away, and I was just like, why is this? Like, have the, you know, he's got charisma for days. She's got a serviceable amount. Like. Mm-hmm. Have them play off of each other. Stop fucking this up with editing. Like, let me see their... And I think, honestly, that's a lot of why most of the character shit that you two were talking about didn't work for me. Because you rarely get to see any of these people literally playing off of each other. It's all hidden in
the edit. I didn't see that.
And the only person who really nails that is Zendaya, but it's primarily because most of her work as Michelle is as a cutaway.
Mm-hmm.
Like, someone will say something, right, and then she'll just shrug and be like, "I like sketching people who are in the pits of despair."
Yeah,
that's fair. You're right. It is definitely those actors. Like, if those moments got to me, it was entirely those actors selling it in random moments. Like the fact where, where Ned is, like, waiting around the corner and they're right in front of a chess club.
Yes.
And the person's like, what are you doing?
Nothing. What about you? Chess.
And that little stuff is just like, I think it does nail that. The blocking stuff, Brian. Yeah. I can see what you're saying there. And we are in total agreement on those, on the action scenes.
Hooray.
But
I don't know. I like, again, like, and then you've just got, like, all the nonsense with Tony Stark towards the end, because, like, he's all like, I'm gonna make you a member of the Avengers, here's a crazy spider suit, I've got 50 reporters, and Peter's like, no, I'm gonna be a neighborhood Spider-Man. And then they, like, I don't even know what the fuck is going on at the end of that, because Tom Holland leaves and then Pepper shows up, and I was like, I thought she left him, I guess.
Gwyneth Paltrow hasn't been in the movies lately.
Right, but in Civil War, didn't he say, like, Pepper left me?
I don't know. Their relationship is real weird.
Super weird.
Sam and Diane.
What's happening there is they're very clearly setting up a marriage proposal. So,
but
I thought that was interesting because Yeah, she was just like, "Wait, you've been holding on to that since 2008? Like, that's weird."
But then she was smiling. That was an odd scene.
Yeah.
Which movie was released in 2008?
I think Iron Man.
Okay. Wait a second. This is another thing. So, like, when was the Avengers released? Because it was fairly recentish, wasn't it?
2010, I believe.
Okay. And then this movie says that, like, this movie is taking place. How
2012.
Many years? Wait, so the Avengers came out in 2012?
Yeah.
Yes, it did.
Okay.
And then this movie says like 8 years later, right?
Mm-hmm.
So this movie is taking place in 2020?
No, it's taking place in 2017.
They're playing with the timeline here every now and then, if you pay attention to when things, because they have jumped around in the time. Of like when these movies come out and when certain sequences are set up. So,
okay, because it shows the aftermath of the first Avengers movie.
Yes,
and it says like 8 years later.
Yep.
And then, so that would be unless Avengers takes place.
Hold on. Here's the thing. Avengers doesn't necessarily have to take place in 2012 because it came out in 2012, right?
I guess
does that make sense?
I'm looking up exactly when it takes place.
Like,
I swear to God, like every one of these movies that comes out, they set up like they there's an official Marvel timeline, and I think all of these movies took place like within 7 months of each other.
It does kind of feel like that sometimes, yeah.
But it doesn't matter. Let's move on. So Liz has to leave because her dad's going to jail. he's not going to rat on Peter, and Michelle is made the lead of the decathlon team and then says that all of her friends call her MJ.
Woohoo!
Which, like, so are they just like, because her name is Michelle, it's not Mary Jane. So is she just going to be the Mary Jane, but instead of calling her Mary Jane, they're going to call her MJ and her name's going to be Michelle?
Yep.
Yes.
I am like not cool with that, but not for the racist reason that most people wouldn't be cool with that. I think that they've made an interesting character who's a billion times better than the nerd wank fantasy that is Mary Jane. And to give her the name MJ is like, is on par with, and I defend The Dark Knight Rises with my very soul, but the stupidest thing in that movie is when the Joseph Gordon-Levitt character says, "My fucking birth name is Robin." Like, don't make that connection. Just like, let this be a new thing. Like, stop the fan service. Michelle is fucking awesome. Peter should be in love with her.
Yes. Yeah. We'll see what they do with that. I also noticed a Felicia Hardy, in the background a couple of times, and you don't cast someone with like silk white hair and then not turn her into Black Cat. Yeah, you notice her in the background.
Who is Felicia Hardy?
Felicia Hardy turns into Black Cat.
Yes, and so she's a major comic book character. She's also kind of a flirtatious with Peter.
And my favorite of all of Peter's women.
Are you talking about Angry Rice?
No. Angry Rice is in this movie?
Yes, she is. Yeah.
She's the news show anchor.
No, but she plays J. Jonas Jameson's daughter, I believe, if I'm not mistaken. So she plays a different character altogether. But yeah, I definitely noticed. Betty Brant. Definitely noticed the silk white haired woman.
I know who you're talking about, Bill, because I remember looking and being like, okay.
Yeah,
like one of the students.
Yeah,
yeah, one of the students in the high school, and they never. She doesn't have like a scene. No, she never has like a speaking part, but she's in two sequences where you can see her in the background, and it's very like I said, you don't cast somebody with silk white hair just because you're casting somebody with silk white hair. You cast that person specifically because you're calling back Felicia Hardy.
I wonder why she's credited as Felicia.
I'm looking in IMDb.
I don't see no one under that name, actually. So probably like white-haired girl. But the funny thing is, like, unless she's, I hope she's a good actress.
Sure.
Unless they're gonna like hire this girl and be like, okay, we need to dye your hair because we're you're Felicia Hardy, but we're not going to call you that. And then they just like replace her in the next film, which would suck for that actress.
Yeah.
Well, what if they?
You know, we've seen weirder things. Yeah. I do want to mention one thing that I liked a lot, and that is Liz's relationship with Peter and what she says to him at the end, because she would have every right to be really, really pissed off at him. She's basically, or he's basically, bailed on her in like huge, crucial, like critical moments on two separate occasions at this point. And she would have every reason to be mad at him. And instead, she just simply says, I hope you figure out whatever is going on with you. And
it's nice concern.
It is. And we don't see that a lot in a lot of these movies, because it's just like, man, there would be so much like angst there from a lot of. And I just don't think this film has that kind of at its heart, which is interesting because Keaton has that kind of at his heart and soul in a lot of ways, even though Keaton very much gives Peter that out. That sequence, once again, even like starting in the house, going into the car, all of that stuff for – you know, the 5-10 minutes that they kind of build up all that tension. I was like, this is fantastic. The way they kind of shoot, you know, you're complaining about the close-ups and things like that. The way they shoot Keaton in a lot of those sequences, though, is fantastic. I think they really nailed that.
Yeah, I think
that specific setup.
Yeah. That's a badass coat.
It is a good coat. I like that coat. I'd wear that coat.
Yeah.
I guess my thing is, like, I'm tired of, like, these serviceable to fine Marvel movies that people flip out about. Like, it's not interesting that they're successful anymore. It's not interesting that they're not bad. This is nowhere near as good of a Spider-Man as Spider-Man or Spider-Man 2. It is markedly better than The Amazings and number 3. But like the first two, just through the auteurish personality of their creator, have more to say and more that is interesting than anything in this movie. And I'm tired of like rote competence being misconstrued as success. And I guess that's what I'm getting at. And I think it's just because, like, for all of Amazing Spider-Man's issues, it was doing something different than the Marvel films were doing. It was terrible. It wasn't good.
The first one I actually kind of like, and I think the action sequences in Amazing Spider-Man are absolutely fantastic.
Like the library fight?
Oh my gosh, yes. Yeah, when he's like sliding around on the ground using the web as like a slingshot in a lot of ways.
There's a
sequence in the sewer where he sets up his webbing as a literal spider web so that he can track people. Like, all of that stuff is just so smart and so genius, and none of that is in this film.
No,
because tech replaces it.
And what's crazy is like. I liked the first Amazing Spider-Man to a point, but it was very much held back by not the treatment of Spider-Man, but the treatment of Peter Parker, and then all of the shit involving his parents. Like, I don't like Peter Parker
making a promise to a dying
man and then immediately breaking it. Like, you know, that just is bad. Like, that's bad PR for Peter Parker. bad PPPR. But in this movie, like, there's none of that. There's none of that personality. There's none of that danger. There's none of the interest. And, like, but people are just, like, so fucking amped to get exactly what they want in the most straightforward, safe, and boring way that it's just kind of, like, it's deadening me inside. And I remember fighting furiously with Daniel Mecca. DJ Mecca. I don't have the air horn sound queued up because I didn't realize it. Thank you, Bill. And he was saying that he liked Batman v Superman more than like Captain America, Civil War, or the Winter Soldier, whichever one had just come out.
I kind of agree with that.
Yeah,
no.
And he said purely because there is an attitude and a personality that is at play in those movies, in the Batman v Superman thing, that you don't get in these like mass produced blah 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 blah. And I told him, but one of them is a competently made movie, and one of them is bullshit. But now I'm like, I'm turning. I can feel myself starting to agree with Dan Mecca, and I hate myself for it, and I hope he doesn't listen to this episode, but I have to say it, because I'm really starting to get it.
Yeah, I mean, there is something to be said for the zaniness and the ballsiness of just going for it in the way that Batman vs. Superman does. And I remember walking out of that film and saying to myself, there are so many issues with that film. There's so many bonkers decisions, whether it's character motivation, whether it's like storyline, whether it's
things like the dream,
camera movements or dream sequences that happened for like no reason. There's so much cut out of that film.
Song choice.
There's so many different choices in that film that just seem absolutely bonkers that would never fly in these Marvel films. And that is because of a Kevin Feige. That's it. And Mecca has mentioned this before on the Slack channel, by the way. Patreon. he's mentioned that before, in that Feige, in a way, is the director of these films, and everybody, or let's go to TV. He is the showrunner.
Yeah.
And all of these directors are basically individual episode directors. That's all they are.
And that's, and like, so it's become a very easy analogy to use, calling the Marvel movies like episodes of a television show. But unfortunately, it's easy because it's right.
Yeah,
So we're not breaking new ground.
That's the way a lot of these films feel.
And it is like you say, like, you're not going to get an episode of Law and Order that's shot like Eraserhead. I would watch that. I would watch the shit out of that. But like that's kind of what Disney is having issues with all of their plans for like Star Wars.
Yeah.
Is they keep having to fire or fuck with these directors who they hire for their vision and then end up like hating the vision of. And
yeah. I don't know what's really going on with Kathleen Kennedy's brain right now.
And we haven't really talked about that on the show because we haven't had a round table in a while, but like, that's what's happening. Like, you know, and here's the thing. TV directors, especially since I've started getting more into, like, the prestige TV, like The Americans and The Leftovers, you can see a lot of a directorial stamp on a certain episode. And I have begun to be able to say, like, oh, if like, Mimi Leder is directing this episode of The Leftovers, or if Michelle McLaren is directing this episode of Game of Thrones, or if Thomas Schlamme is directing this episode of The Americans, I know what kind of episode that's going to be in a tonal and emotional sense.
Yeah.
Or Vincenzo Natali is directing an episode of Hannibal. It's just going to be flat out bonkers because him and Brian Fuller are not going to stop
the same
each
wavelength.
Other.
And David
yeah, they're not going to stop each other, and they're just going to go bananas, right? Like, I love Natali's episodes.
David Slade's episodes, because I feel like he reins in a little bit, like just enough. Because Brian Fuller can go a little nuts sometimes. But anyway.
What I'm saying is it should be said,
and it's annoying as shit. The truth of the analogy is annoying as shit, not the analogy itself.
Yes.
Well, that's kind of the reason why I think we've kind of like found ourselves in this endless film versus TV conversation is, you know, that didn't used to be the case. I mean, to point to something, I've been rewatching Deadwood lately, and you know, you have a lot of directors there who do have a very signature stamp. You know, you have Walter Hill, and you have David Milch and Davis Guggenheim, and you know, all these people, and. But that does feel like more of a house style compared to when you do look at prestige TV. And prestige TV is this odd thing where they are, you know, loosening the reins and saying, yeah, you want to do that? You do that. And there is – I think that is why that film versus TV conversation becomes even weirder, because, you know, there's a lot of people who aren't – watching non-blockbuster movie. I'm going to make a reductive statement here, but stick
Do
with
it.
Me first.
Do it. Reduce okay. them.
I think the reason why the film versus TV conversation is really dumb is partly that the people who are championing TV see a lot of bad films.
Well, yeah.
Just as a lot of people who are saying film is better and watch a wide variety don't watch some TV that's also like on the outsets that's doing really interesting stuff.
Right. Like, I mean, there's your Transformers on your one end and your Big Bang Theories is
sure.
on the other. This sure. is the episode where I just like don't know how to pluralize things.
But that's what I'm saying is there's such a weird confrontation there because both of them aren't actually recognizing the possibility and peaks of the medium in each thing. Like it's such a pointless conversation,
right.
but one that Marvel serves as a perfect stand-in for because there's no greater embodiment for commerce and entertainment clashing than the Marvel machine.
Yeah.
And similarly, you can point to something, like especially sitcoms. You could point to them, even the good ones, and it is very much like they are following that template to a T where you can literally guarantee, okay, that is going to be a shot reverse shot right mm-hmm. there.
Well, what's and funny is like to that end, like I recently rewatched the entirety of Frasier.
Yeah.
And Frasier, like, it's great. It's wonderful. It's a three-camera sitcom. And, like, so after I finished watching Frasier, which I had caught, like, a couple episodes here and there when I was younger, but I was like, I'm an older, sophisticated man now. Yes. I'll probably yes. get all the jokes this time. After I did that, I was like, what's another, like, 90s sitcom I could watch? And so I started watching Friends. And I got to
about, I was just about to say, yeah.
I got to about the middle of the second season before I noped out of that fucking show.
Because it's a bad show.
It's terrible. Like, Chandler and Joey are funny. Phoebe is cute and, like, good-hearted. And Monica has, like, a weird manic twitchiness to her that I like.
Yes. Well,
Ross and Rachel, whoever... I don't know what was wrong with America that they became like the heart and soul of that show because they're both miserable fucking people who don't deserve happiness. And most of the jokes
I really
in that
don't
show,
like Ross. I really don't like Ross.
I don't like Ross. Yeah. I don't like Rachel. And
too.
In that way, they deserve each other. But like, I after watching the perfect like satire and screwball comedy setup and knockdown of Frasier, watching
sure.
Friends was horrible. And I was like, even back in the day, before we had this concept of the golden age or the second golden age
sure.
or peak TV, there were very distinct differences. So, like, I feel what you're saying. Like, there, it's don't let's make a comment right here. We're never going to have the conversation of what's better, TV or film.
That's mm-hmm. a dumb fucking conversation.
Thank you. So we're never going to do it. We're never going to
deal.
Do it.
Deal. Blood oath.
We've all sworn a blood oath. If we should ever actually make that, I'll consign someone to come and murder all of us.
I don't care if it's the nuclear apocalypse. We're not doing it.
okay.
Any final thoughts? Like, we've gotten way off the topic. As is our
one last final thing.
Yeah.
I was very appreciative of the throwback to the animated series song at the beginning of the opening title credits.
Oh, really?
Very happy
I
with
don't
that.
Remember what y'all that did, is?
Yeah, I didn't remember that. Okay.
No.
Wait, did it play the da na 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 na?
Yep. Yes, it
oh,
does.
I didn't hear that.
Yep.
Or I don't remember
Spectacular
it.
Spectacular Spider-Man or whatever
oh.
the thing is.
Last thing, by
no,
the way,
it's not the Spectacular Spider-Man. It's just Spider-Man.
Yeah.
Spider-Man does
yep.
whatever. Because there is a Spectacular Spider-Man song.
Yes. I think all of these different animated versions have all had their own specific song.
I will say that the Spectacular Spider-Man theme song is not great. From my memory of it, it's a little bit like, you know, mid-2000s kind of like alt-pop.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yep. Yeah, I've heard that. I don't like it. I skip that.
Right.
Like, you can go
my
away.
My last thought is... you know, if you are going to do the credits thing, and I hate that, don't fucking taunt me for staying till the end of the movie. Like, I was so angry
it
at
really
that.
Should be.
Like, oh man,
I don't know. I found it delightful, but I also found this is a weird nitpick, but it's something that I've harped on forever. He has a very specific helmet design that cropped up in the Avengers movie, which was absolutely terrible. And they went away from it from that point forward, and they went away from it in the first Captain America movie. But it cropped up in the first Avengers movie, and he's wearing that same stupid, goofy-ass looking helmet. And it,
well,
I was just like,
assuming
thank
those
you?
Videos were made like right after the exactly. Avengers did their thing.
Exactly. Yeah. And so
that's good.
You know,
that's good continuity.
It is good continuity, and I was very happy to see it, and I was very happy to be like, yep, there's that ugly ass helmet again. I hate that helmet design. It is the worst. Very, very small thing that we can end on, because Bill has very, very big issues with very small things in a lot of films.
That is a perfect way to end this episode.
It's a good podcast.
So, ladies and gentlemen, that's our thought. That's our thoughts. That's our numerous. Those are our numerous thoughts. God damn it.
Don't look at how long we were recording. Don't do it.
I already did. It's not a great situation to be in. Anyway, so yeah, those are our numerous thoughts on this movie. It's out now. Michael and I both apparently both gave it 3 stars. Like I said, if you want a fucking Marvel Spider-Man movie, this is your Marvel Spider-Man movie, and I can't assume that anyone who's looking forward to that will be disappointed by it.
Yep.
So that's it. Find us all over the place. First of all, give to our Patreon. You can find our Patreon at patreon.com/thefilmstageshow. We are currently giving away a Blu-ray of Free Fire, the new film by Ben Wheatley. What else was I going to say? Mubi is also sponsoring us. And Mubi, of course, is the streaming cinema where some of the best independent foreign and all-around great films are featured every day. 30 films at a time, one new film each day, living for a period not to exceed 30 days. And so you always have 30 rotating films to watch. A bunch of great stuff on there. The Wicker Man is still on there. If you want to see a movie that truly does not give a shit about what genre it's in, go check out the original Wicker Man on Mubi right now. For your free 30-day trial, go to mubi.com/filmstage. And yeah, that's that. So gentlemen, let's tell the fine people at home where we can be found between now and the next time. Bill Graham.
I don't know. You can find me on Twitter at CableBFG. You can also find me writing about movies on the film stage and freshfiction.tv, but mainly hanging out in the Patreon page or Slack channel, where we have a lot of fun discussions. I'm looking forward to seeing what people think about this. We've already gotten some mixed reactions from Baby Driver, and I was very curious to see that.
I understand people who are mad at my opinion of Baby Driver more than I will understand people who are mad about my opinion of
Scott Pilgrim
Spider-Man Homecoming.
Oh, okay.
I just can't imagine being passionate about this film. Anyway, we're done talking about it. Michael, where are you found online, sir?
You can find me never having a conversation about television versus film on Twitter at Snydell. And I got some things I can plug. I interviewed David Lowery, the director of A Ghost Story.
Yeah.
Very soon. And I'm also going to be on a lovely podcast called Alcoholicwood. And I will tweet when that is up. I'll be talking about The Shallow.
Oh, nice. All right. I can be found on Twitter at Brian J. Rowan, letterboxed at Brian J. Rowan. My personal site, dearfilm.net, and of course, writing for thefilmstage.com. Remember to follow our entire podcast on Twitter at Film Stage Show, Facebook, The Film Stage Show, emails podcast at filmstage.com, or, yeah, that's right. And iTunes, guys, comments, ratings, give them to us. But between now and then, and all those places you can find us, next time we will be coming at you with
The Big Sick, probably a ghost story next week for you guys.
Yeah, The Big Sick.
If it's
ghost
if
story.
It's out, yeah.
And then the monkeys. Oh, I'm sorry. The apes, the aliens, and the British people on a beach.
Woo!
Yeah. So much going on. All right, ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much for joining us, and tune in next time. And you're taking up my time. Don't have the courage inside me.
No doubt it's good singles.
Yeah, no, their Tragic Kingdom era stuff was great.